Welcome to Interculture Yoga, a place where we experiment and practice the fine art of knowing that our learning begins where our comfort zone ends. And today I have the perfect guest and mentor and friend and colleague, Aaron Jones. Someone said this to me one time, and I don't know who said it, so it's not me, and I'm not plagiarizing Aaron, but something to the effect that God thinks in the genius, creates in the poet, and sleeps in the rest of us. God does not sleep in you. I know the power of story because I know you. And so let's just get right down to it. Let's get right down to some areas of mutuality around the spiritual significance of human difference, particularly in the body of work that you do, but also where I work here at Gonzaga University. How did you come to do what you have been doing for over 30 years is amazing to me. And one of the stories that you tell is that moment when you knew what your calling would be. Maybe kind of go back to that a little bit in Philly when you met Dr. J. And incidentally, you've met some incredible people in your life. You lived a mythopoetic existence, let me tell you. And at the end of this time, I think our listeners will appreciate what I just said. So what happened in that moment when you're having a conversation with these young men after playing basketball with Julius Erving in Philly? Why was that this golden moment of awareness around what you're calling, what your destiny and purpose would be in life?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm really honored to be in your presence. So I see you as a mentor of my own. So it's interesting. Mutuality. I think I actually want to back up the first time that I knew purpose to the first time where I felt like I heard kind of in my spirit. So I didn't really understand spiritual things at the time, but I want to go back to a moment because I think that will speak to the moment that was coming. You know, when I was, first of all, I was abandoned at birth, adopted by white people, raised in Europe at the United Nations School. I would meet the president of Egypt's wife in 1979. And if those of you who don't remember, Egypt was in the middle of a civil war in 79 to 80, and Anwar Sadat was the president. And his wife, watching everything that was going down in her own country, had this vision to travel the world and talk with little kids, like elementary school children, about peace. And so she decided to try out this assembly with children, and she called my school first because my school served children from 70 countries, and it was adjacent to the World Court, the United Nations World Court in The Hague. And so she would show up on our campus when I was 9 years old, and I would have the opportunity to hear her speak. And then I was chosen as one of three little kids to have lunch with her afterwards. And I had been chosen because my teacher told her, Erin is something else. Like already my fourth grade teacher knew there's something different about Aaron. And the reason my teacher said that is because I had a really good friend in the fourth grade named Yael, who was Israeli. Her father was the Israeli ambassador. And of course, in 79, Israel and Palestine were heavy at it. And I had decided already as a fourth grader, I'm going to bring peace between Israel and Palestine. I had decided that already at 9 years old. Just listening to my nine-year-old friend, I knew I wanted to make a difference for her. My heart broke for her. And so here I am at nine. I've already decided I'm going to solve the Middle East crisis. And then I get to meet Mrs. Sadat. Wow. And she asked us three little nine-year-olds, so what are you going to do to change the world? And I knew immediately. I raised my hand and I said, I'm going to bring peace to Israel and Palestine. And I mean, I didn't understand the significance of that exactly at nine. But here's what she said to me. She pointed at me in the face and she said, you, Aaron, are a world changer. Not you will be someday. Not I see all kinds of potential in you. But she spoke into me, you are a world changer. And I, from that moment on, knew that I was meant to change the world in some way. And I thought at the time, because my little nine-year-old self just knew the United Nations, I knew Israel and Palestine, in my mind, it was natural I should bring peace to the Middle East. And that's kind of all I thought about. And I knew that that needed to bring me back to America because that's where the best colleges were. And if I was going to work at the United Nations, I needed to have a degree from Harvard or Stanford or Yale. Mm-hmm. I knew that as a little kid because that's all the parents of the children I went to school with. That's where they had gone to school. So I worked to get to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. And I ended up getting accepted at Princeton. But Princeton didn't give me any money because they never looked at my FAFSA form to see that I was a teacher's kid. They just assumed United Nations school, rich kid. And even though I graduated number two in my class, 3.9 GPA, 11 AP classes, 4 languages fluently, 3 varsity sports I was the captain of, Princeton gave me no money. And so I got a yes from Princeton. But as a teacher's kid, my parents were like, yeah, that's not happening. And I was devastated, but I'd end up with a scholarship to Bryn Mawr College, which is the sister school to Princeton. And I would come to America sight unseen as an 18-year-old kid, thinking that it was a post-civil rights America. Mm. I, in my mind, thought, oh, every Black person, and by the way, if you're on the podcast, I'm a 6-foot-tall Black woman with a giant afro, so I don't hide anywhere. But I had walked in Europe as Aaron. I hadn't walked in Europe as Black woman. And in fact, I hadn't even walked in Europe as American Aaron, because I spoke French fluently. I spoke Dutch fluently. I could speak German enough that people didn't assume I was American. So I got to be Aaron from my entire childhood. And then I came to America and my first identity was suddenly Black and then woman and then not really Black. And, oh, athlete can't possibly be smart. And it was this, my first year of college was horrible and I almost committed suicide, but it was on a basketball court one day, right at the end of my first year of college, literally as I was considering, how do I take my own life? Mm-hmm. That I would meet three high school age Black boys who had all dropped out of high school. And I went to a college in a very white area, but I played I found this basketball court in a Black small community where the help lived. And Dr. J happened to live in my college town, but he had built a basketball court in this tiny little community because he knew, he recognized there was something very wrong with this dynamic. And he would show up and play there on occasion. And he just happened to be playing there one day. The day I discovered the court, he happened to be there. And I would play with him and I didn't know who he was, which is super embarrassing. But I would sit on the sidelines with these three young Black men at 18, they were probably 16, 17 years old, and all of them had dropped out of their school in North Philadelphia. And as they described education in America for Black children, my heart was broken, much like it had been for my friend Yael in Israel. And I realized, I looked at them and I looked at myself, and I thought, as much as I love Israel and Palestine, I know this is what I was made for. I was made to be a bridge for these children, because God put me in this skin with this hair and this story. And I knew immediately, oh my gosh, I was born in this country, in this body, but raised in a country that believed in me for a purpose. And I knew that day on the basketball court, I was not meant to bring peace to the Middle East. That was my window into changing the world, but really there's a world change that needs to happen right here in the country where I was born. And I never looked back. 31 years ago, that occasion took place, and I knew that I would devote the rest of my life to being a champion for young people.
You know, what's amazing that what I know about you is that you do it by what James Baldwin once described any good educator does, is they're a disturber of the peace, that you interrupt people's trance and you confuse them with what they think they know based on inviting them to challenge your assumptions. And when I heard you speak a couple of weeks ago, one of the things that struck me, you gave 3 immediate examples on how to just pivot differently about something real quick. And one was the distinction between setting group norms when you're going to start a class and having community agreements. You know, the difference between that, the difference between safe space and brave space. And the third thing you did was this idea of when somebody says something that upsets you, and don't be defensive, or that you did something that you didn't realize you did. Don't be defensive. Just say, I'm sorry. So those are 3 very quick examples where you just interrupt the trance. That's been your life story, right? I mean, but you do it with such grace. You don't do it in an obnoxious way where then someone's putting fire out with gasoline and the volatility. Actually, when you do those golden moments of insight and reevaluation, it kind of de-escalates the energy in a way. Tell me more about that. What's that about?
I mean, wow, there are so many things that are wrapped up in that. Number one, I am an expert in middle-class white culture. I'm just going to start there. My parents are middle-class white people. I went to a middle to upper middle-class wealthy school. I am a student. I have been a student of culture my entire life. And so, and being in Europe, you know, in a, the tiny country of the Netherlands, I had to study culture to survive, right? Because the Netherlands is like 2 hours from the next place, from one end to the other, it's 2 hours. And so I learned as a small kid, you know, I had been to 12 countries by the time I was 14. I learned to watch culture and to watch how people functioned from one nation to another, to watch how people greeted one another, to watch how they communicated. But when you are in that space, you learn to be an expert at the culture you're in the most. And so I became an expert in white culture. And so the gift that is I understand white culture. I understand the rules of white culture enough to know how to break the rules. Here's a lesson that I tell students all the time. And I learned this as an athlete. And Raymond, you know, you're an athlete too. You know, I played basketball for 40 years and soccer for 20 years. I played softball for 12 years. I'm a runner now. The reality of especially basketball, but soccer too, is that you have to know the rules so well that you know where the edge of the rules are.
Yeah.
Right. And as a big man, you know, I played post. You got to know, like, how much can I push? How much can I push before they're going to call a foul?
Yeah.
I don't want to get called in a foul, but I want to know I'm going to push right up to the boundary. It's the same with white culture and with disrupting. Is I know how far I can push without getting a foul called. And I really believe that God intentionally placed me into this white family, into this white space to really understand that, but then gave me this skin and this experience. And I'm married to a Black man and I have taught in all Black schools and I've lived in all Black environments. And so I've been able to experience what is the true story of America and the reality that not everyone in America does have equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. Not everyone in America does get to move in the same way. And so I get to use the rules of middle-class white society and disrupt and really use those rules to disrupt. And I tell people all the time, I am on the basketball court, I'm super tough and I will push and I've broken every single finger on my hands because I am really rough. In real life, though, I try to move with grace. I move realizing that I don't know it all, that I can't do it by myself. And so when I move, especially in white spaces, I want to challenge people with a courageous kind of love that calls them in, not out. That centers humanity, not inhumanity. We have done a lot as a country, especially in the last 4 years, but really over the last 10 years that I've been in the United States, to dehumanize. Mm-hmm. And we dehumanize an other in a variety of ways, whether it's based on politics or skin color or home language or nationality. We spend a lot of time dehumanizing people. And I really believe that God has given me a message of humanizing and humanity. Let's center the humanity of our brothers and sisters. And those of you who are people of faith, you know, God talks about we are all made in his image. Every single one is made in his image. Guess what? That Muslim who believes things is made in his image.
Yeah.
That super liberal left-wing person is made in God's image. And so whether I agree with you politically or philosophically or not, I choose to show up in every space and center people's humanity and then challenge us to think about what are the ways that we're showing up that dehumanize others.
Yeah.
And I want to call people higher, but I need to model that first with my own behavior, right, and how I show up.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is a marathon. I've heard you talk before about pushing through, like when the example you give is when you go for a walk, it's that first half mile, that first mile that's uncomfortable, but then you just get beyond that zone of being uncomfortable. Racism has often been described as the original sin of this country, that it was taken on stolen land. It was by stolen bodies and stolen land. I mean, the history is replete. How do you deal with white fragility? How is it that we need to begin to decenter whiteness as the master narrative so we can truly have a multicultural democracy in this country? Yet the white supremacy continues in terms of its fear and its reaction to issues of inclusion and equity. Where is a sweet spot where we begin to have the empathetic insight around solidarity and common ground at the same time making the white majority uncomfortable? How do we do that?
So, yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I have spent the last couple months just listening to podcasts about this and reading the Bible. And I think, so let me offer a couple of responses to that. Number one, I believe racism is our original sin, and it shows up in, and I was just listening to a podcast, and I'll come up with the name of the podcast in a second, because I think every person who calls themselves a Christian should listen to this podcast, and I'll find the name of it. But there's a really amazing podcast that I just came across the other day that talks about the reality that the white man who came to this land originally had to have in his mind, and I'm going to use him because I think gender also played a role in this, had to have in his mind that the Native American was not equally human.
Right.
Had to already come with that notion in his mind, because the foundations and the way that the Native peoples were treated, and the fact that he could or they could think that this land was theirs, to be taken. Right. They had to come to this country with that notion. They had to bring Africans to this land with the notion that they were less human. And there are lots of Christian people that shared that narrative broadly, that supported that narrative. And so I would argue that for those of us who are believers, 2 Chronicles 7:14 talks about, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves, seek my face, pray, turn from their wicked ways, then will I heal their land, and then I will hear them. I believe that's the place we are right now. And this is what I'm calling the church to, that I think there are two ways to do this talking about racism. I think there's one group of people that are, they want to fight about it and get aggressive, and all white people are bad and y'all are racist. And I don't show up with that, because I'm a believer in Jesus who believes that we are all born in sin. And so by the grace that I am saved, I want to show up for other people in this work that way, that I am broken too in lots of ways. I am flawed too. And so I don't show up that way because I want to do this with the heart of God. But I also believe what God's heart says is we can't fix what we're not willing to face. Mm-hmm. And this sin is sin. And just because it was your forefathers. So I would say to any white Christians that are listening today, you know, lots of white Christians will say to me, well, Aaron, my people didn't own slaves.
Right.
But guess what? You benefited from white people having slaves. You benefited from that. And for so many churches, whether it's the Presbyterian Church or the Lutheran Church or the Baptist Church, there were clear expressions that Black people were less than white people. And so I believe until we're really ready to truly repent of that original sin, we're going to continue to find ourselves in broken places.
Yeah.
We're going to, and it's not about just white people being bad. It's about we as human beings are flawed and broken. And as a nation, our foundation, I think about the houses, right? It's our foundation was on sand. We did not start this nation in an honest way. We did not start this nation by centering the humanity of all people here, because there were already people here. There were already people who had been on this land, and we just indiscriminately wiped them out and pushed them aside. And I think until, as a people, we are willing to face our truth and not with shame, blame, and guilt, because I think that paralyzes us. Yeah. And that's where I think also white people can get caught up in, oh, we just think we're so bad as people. No, get out of that. That's pride. That turns you on yourself. And now you're feeling sorry for you. Pivot away, pivot back to, let's look at God's face. What God says is we're all made in his image. And repentance says, you can't just say you're sorry. We have to now, as the church, step in and fix. We got to repair the breach. Right. We got to fix the breach. Right. And so the last thing I would say on this is, I also believe I'm seeing lots of church spaces super critical of Black Lives Matter as a movement. And I would say to you, then where are you? Where are you? You don't get to be critical if you're not stepping in. And I think that's been the most painful thing for me to watch, is the incredible critique of the Black Lives Matter movement. I am critical of the Black Lives Matter movement, and I'm doing work.
Right.
And so I get to be critical because I'm in the arena doing work on this. So church folks, I need y'all to stop being critical of that movement, because there's a gap. There's a need. And the church is not stepping into the gap. So I would invite, whether you're Catholic or Protestant, however you show up, if you don't like that movement, I need you to step in, and we need to be part of the solution.
Yeah. Well, it's also equally important to not only know what you're against, but what you're for, and be able to do that. And I also like the idea of suspending certainty. You talked earlier about, in previous times I've heard you speak, this idea of being curious. Maintain your level of curiosity, suspend certainty, and be able to listen so you can get the full story of the other, whoever the other is. And you demonstrated that in a story that you told. And if it's the same person that I think, in 1987, I was on a panel with his father, who was Richard Butler. I don't know whether he was the same person that you talked about, a person living north of Spokane who was—
Oh, no, it's John Smith.
John Smith, okay. But but that he had ideologies and thoughts and opinions that were contrary to yours, but you were able— he was able to see you for who you are, and you were able to see him, this unconditional love, I think, that you're describing. Without suspending or giving up, surrendering your beliefs, you could cohabitate space with him, even though many times you had conflicting ideas. Was there a golden moment in when you were discussing things with him where you began to see that you had common ground, made in the image and likeness of God, a chip off the old block? Because I think that if we can replicate that as a case study, we begin seeing the dynamics of being able to understand that polarization is what we're going to have to deal with the next 3 or 4 years. 70 million people voted a certain way. There's great polarization in this country right now, and a need for deep healing. And it's going to be a long human difference. And I think going back to this relationship, this friend that you have, it's an interesting story of how you went from, you know, being very polarized to being able to actually, be interested in each other's lives and care about each other.
Well, it started with him following me on social media. When I ran for political office, he just started following my political page, and he actually followed it for 2 years without ever commenting. So he followed it when I was running. And then when I stopped running, I felt like God said, keep your page going. So I just kept my page going, and my political page became the page where I was talking about what I was thinking. So my personal page is what I'm doing. My public page is what I'm thinking about. Okay. And it's a lot about faith and the political process, faith and justice. And that's what I write about. And so he just kept following me for years afterwards. And about 2 years ago, he reached out to me privately and said, hey, Aaron, my name is John. I've been following you. I've never commented because I just wasn't sure quite what to say, but I realized in following you that I need to know how to love better. He said, you are demonstrating love in a way that I haven't seen it before. And I really want to better understand that kind of love. And I really think I would really like to meet you in person someday. And at the time, you know, I live in Olympia and he lives north of Spokane, and he said, anytime you happen to be in Spokane, I'd love to take you out for coffee. Well, about 2 months later, I was invited to speak at the National Day of Prayer in Spokane. And so I said to John, hey, I'm going to be in Spokane. Maybe we can have coffee afterwards. I didn't realize that he lived like 2 hours north of Spokane, and the breakfast is at 7 o'clock in the morning. But I invited him to come, and I didn't know if he would show up. But I get done with my speech, and he's there in line waiting to say hello with his wife and their brand new baby and their 15-year-old son. He had brought his family with him. And I'll never forget this because he has bright, so I have red hair, but he has like that orange red, like Irish red hair. And I just remember seeing him and being super emotional that he would come all the way and that it would be important enough for him to bring his, I think the baby was like 5 or 6 months old and his wife and his 15-year-old son. And he said, well, I know you've already had a long morning, but can we take you for coffee? And so we sit in the hotel coffee area for an hour and a half and just share our stories. And by the end, we are like brother and sister. I mean, it is just, we go deep in our life stories. And so here's what I would say, Raymond, that I absolutely believe is true. And Dr. King talks about this all the time. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talks about this. I believe the story is our connection. Yeah. Our personal stories is where our humanity lies. And the truth about all of our stories, regardless of our skin color, regardless of our status, is we have all experienced tragedy. We've all experienced success, whether little or big. We've all experienced sadness, sorrow, loss. We've all walked through stuff. And when we can share those stories with one another, that's where we find our humanity. And if we could just get curious about one another. So I tell people as an educator, one of the reasons I believe I'm a good teacher is I am a treasure hunter. I am always digging for treasure. So give me the toughest students. I am constantly digging for treasure, but I do that in everyone. So anyone that I meet, even the salty, surly old man, I will find treasure in them. And so I approach every encounter with people that way, that, okay, help me to find the treasure. And God always helps me to find the treasure.
Yeah. Well, and I think as educators, we're about the human creativity. The teaching and learning process is a creative act. And so if you can stir that restless curiosity, all kinds of things can happen. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that about buried treasure is, I think it was Felix Cohen that said that they buried us and they forgot we were seeds. And I think that it's really interesting that if we can identify, why is it that some people swim in the same waters in which others drown? And it goes to the idea of resilience and that your story does matter. And that how can you learn from your story? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
So I did find the podcast. I would encourage anyone who's interested about this stuff. It's America's Unholy Ghosts with Joel Edward Goza. And Joel Edward Goza is the author of a book that talks about the original history of American Christians. And he's a white man who really, he lives in, I want to say either Houston or Dallas, and talks about as a white man in a predominantly Black community, when he moved into the community for the first time, he realized that, oh, wow, they are not experiencing the same things as I did as a white man in a white community. And he begins to do some history of the America, of the United States, and realizes, oh my gosh, we have this history that we need to confess. We need to repent. Exactly. And he calls us to a repentance.
Yeah. Well, what is it? The Desmond Tutu's book, There's No Future Without Forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And first of it is what you talked about is taking responsibility for that dark part of our history. You're right.
Right.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So where is your learning curve? You know, sometimes what I'm always interested in is what are people reading or what are they putting their attention on? But with leaders like you, educational leaders like you, I think it's more interesting to find out where your fears are and where your vulnerabilities are, where your learning curve, the edge is, or what you're navigating right now in your life. If you had to say, what is one of your major challenges right now as you regulate your emotions and your impulse control and, you know, trying to emulate that love that your friend had talked about. Where are you being challenged right now? Where are the rough edges?
So I would say my greatest challenge right now is other people who call themselves Christians who just are not manifesting Christ. I mean, I'm really having a hard time with kind of the church, the organized church and the many ways that those who were leading church spaces, especially at the national level, but also in community, leaders and parishioners who say they love Jesus, who in their rhetoric say things that don't center the humanity of all people. And, you know, one of the things I posted about a couple weeks ago, but I've been talking about this for a while, is I really believe our greatest sin as a nation right now, especially, is arrogance and pride. But I see that manifesting in the church more than anywhere else, and in people who call themselves believers in Jesus. And so I would say my greatest struggle right now is loving people who say they're brothers and sisters in Christ who are not behaving like brothers and sisters in Christ. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, Jesus, help me to love them.
Well, that's the deal, is that the Jesuits often say that the active presence of God in all things, and that all things come from God, even evil comes from God. And it's so hard when we live in the binary of either or. How do you reach the promised land of end both? How do you draw that circle larger to include the excluded? And you're right. I mean, I think that Cornel West talked about one of the noblest things that people can do is to track hypocrisy with compassion. So how do we track the gap between thought, word, and deed? The word integrity means to be integrated, that your heart and your mind and your behavior are aligned. They're integrated. So there's coherence. But when there is not any coherence, how do you reconcile that? How do you love that person? And then the hypocrisy piece that you talked about earlier reminds me of here in this area in Spokane, Washington, where the area nations had their compound at Hayden Lake. Many of them, and Randy Weaver and Sandpoint and others, talked about double seat theology and about the white Christian identity movement. And the white Christian identity movement, here again, using Christianity to justify, mm-hmm. rationalize, and explain racism, you know, to be able to use the word of God to create divisiveness and cultural genocide under the name of God.
And we see that, I mean, we see that in so many ways. It's so interesting because, you know, you're asking what books am I reading? Well, I'm teaching 5 classes a day. I don't have time to read because when I'm not teaching, I'm walking or running. So I'm listening to podcasts, and I'm listening to like Lisa Sharon Harper, Freedom Road podcast, Words Matter. I'm listening, Quick to Listen is another one that I'm listening to. So I'm trying to listen to Jesus folks who are really thinking about these things in different ways. And I'm trying to learn to listen again with curiosity and to try to understand. But when we see even all the events that happened on January 6th, right? You see the cross and the gallows, and you see Holy Bible on people's shirts, and there's prayer in the Senate, but next to it, you see anti-Semitic language on people's shirts and anti-Blackness on, yeah, I mean, it's just that weird. It's a spiritual battle. It's a spiritual battle, but there are so many ways that the Bible, I mean, and this is over thousands of years, but you know, the Bible has been used as a weapon in many ways. I mean, I think about my degree was in literatures of the African diaspora in English, French, and Spanish. So I studied colonization and the literature that came out of colonization. I mean, colonization is an expression of the Bible being used as a weapon against brown people, right? I mean, so this is not a new playbook. This is an old playbook that's being used again. I mean, I think about really Auschwitz. I think about World War II. I mean, so often the Bible is used as a weapon. I mean, I don't understand anti-Semitism. My husband and I talk about this all the time because Jesus was a Jew, and I just don't understand the hatred by so many Christians of Jewish people. And I mean, this is something that we have dealt with as a world, as a globe, for hundreds of years, using the Bible as a weapon and as a tool of white supremacy. And I would offer, I've been teaching on white supremacy characteristics. There's a really great article, The 13 Characteristics of White Supremacy Culture. I think often we look at neo-Nazi folks and we look at KKK and we say, that's white supremacy, I'm not that. I would offer though, that there are a lot of qualities they believe in that are pervasive in American culture that have just become so much a part of the fabric. I would argue they're killing us all. It's not just killing black and brown people. It's this notions of perfection and even manifest destiny that we are we are destined to be the greatest. I mean, we are nowhere in the Bible. We are not in the Bible, by the way, y'all find me, America, in the Bible. We are not there. But I think, again, it's these characteristics that we have elevated as being, they are kind of in opposition with what the Bible teaches. And so, you know, a lot of times people talk about spreading the love of Jesus, and oftentimes it's spreading American culture more than it's spreading the love of Jesus.
Knowing
it's
the difference.
Yeah. And I just, you know, when people say, let's get back to the Bible, let's stop talking about race, it's complicated because it's not that simple, because the Jesus that so many Americans worship is a white American Jesus. If you were to go to any other South American, Central American, the continent of Africa, and see their expression of Jesus, it's very different from the expression of Jesus here. And I've had the opportunity to see that because I've traveled a lot. But most Americans, this is what they know, and they don't realize that their notion of Christianity is really so entangled with American. That how can we just get back to Jesus until we're willing to really look at what is our lens for the church and Christianity? How has that been tainted by our origin story?
No, that's so true. That is so true. And I'm wondering, when the day is done, what do we fear? What are we fearing? A lot of different therapists and theorists talk about what are the essentials for a young baby coming into the world. And, you know, developmentally speaking, first you got to feel safe so you can trust. And then you have to learn to be dependent so you can be independent and autonomous. And just this whole idea of how you then transport those emotional intelligences or spiritual literacies to the practical matter of race, inclusion, and equity. And that seems to be the challenge as we're moving deeper into this 21st century. You've heard this before, that if you want a 1-year plan, plant rice. You want a 20-year plan, plant a tree. You want a 100-year plan, teach a child. And I suspect that's why you're in education. So wanting to move towards what we want and anti-racism versus being against race, but being for structures of inclusion, it's a shift in attitude. You know, is the glass half empty or half full? Are you a pessimist or an optimist? I mean, those economies back and forth. How do you maintain your sense of hope? And these are dark times, but how do you delight in your call in life, that you're delightful still despite what's around you? How do you feel your hope, your sense of hope and optimism?
So there are a couple of things. Number one, I watch my young adult children just be amazing humans who love people and really are standing up for what's right for people. My daughter works for the Equity and Education Coalition, so she is doing work around racial justice every day, even though she's the one of my kids who said, this work is not important. And now that's what she does for a living, which is kind of awesome. My oldest son is dating a white woman that we've known since she was 2, just a beautiful human being. And they are navigating this stuff. And what's really cool is watching her on my Facebook page. She reads everything I write and she asks me questions. And I'm just like, you know what? I know that they'll get married soon, but as they walk through life, are living out the things that we've been teaching. And that, to watch your children step into that is pretty amazing. Yeah. But I would also say that one of the things that gives me life, and it's a reason that even though I'm not a formal teacher anymore in a classroom, I have a class that I teach every week. And I've been teaching, even through the pandemic, I taught 83 days in a row, straight through from March 16th until June 30th. I taught every day. What is in your hands? God said, what's in your hand, Aaron? I said, teaching and a computer. He said, give it away. So I did. What he knew is that what would give me life is young people and their curiosity. And so I, through the hardest season of our country's history, watching Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, watching people die, I had eight friends die from February to October. What God knew is that young people give me life. And so he gave me this community of young people that have stayed with me through the spring into the summer. And then now I have a group of young people I meet with every Friday and every Monday night. And what's amazing, there are 2 young white girls. They are 10 and 13 years old, and they come every week. And these white girls are on it around race. And it's phenomenal to watch these two young women who absolutely can tell you why it's important to talk about race. And to watch them talk about why it matters. And one of the young ladies actually ran for vice president of her school ASB as a middle school, she's an eighth grader, was not a talker a year ago, but because she was in my class, she found her voice in the spring and she decided in the fall to run for vice president. Well, no one ran for president. So they nominated her as the president of her school. She attends a school that's predominantly African-American, Black on the hilltop in Tacoma. And here's this white girl, ASB president of a predominantly Black school, advocating for her peers, making sure that their school is talking about race, making sure that they're doing Black History Month right. That gives me life to watch young people step into this different consciousness about this. And that absolutely keeps me doing the work.
All right. So what is it about one quality that you have that without that you would not be you? I'm just curious about that. One quality that you have that if you didn't have that quality, you would not be you. Is there anything, one defining element, disposition, default setting, master narrative that really is the golden essence of Erin Jones?
I think there are actually two qualities. So I would say I'm tenacious. Like I will fight and fight and fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. And I'm not afraid to lose. So, and I say that because, you know, as an athlete, probably, and I said this when I ran for office too, but I absolutely believe this to be true. The greatest skill I learned as an athlete, and I was a top level athlete. I mean, I played college basketball and soccer. I tried out for two WNBA teams. In high school, I was MVP of three different sports. Like I was a top level athlete, but you know, every athlete loses. I've never met an athlete. Michael Jordan was my hero as a kid. He lost games. Yep. He lost games, lost seasons, lost tournaments, right? One of the greatest skills I learned is how to lose and get back up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that skill has gotten me further than anything else. I've lost some big things. I've lost some huge things. I've lost a campaign. I didn't get chosen to play in the WNBA when I tried out. Lots of reasons to want to quit. And yet I'm so used to getting back up. Like losing is just part of life. And you just get back up and you try again. And I think that has gotten me really far, that I'm not afraid to try hard things because I've tried hard things and I've lost and I've gotten back up. And I really believe that for me, the greatest things have been birthed out of my biggest losses.
Yeah.
And so I am not afraid to try hard stuff. And I'm not afraid to fall down while I'm doing it.
I can't remember how you exactly said it, but you reminded me of something when you were reflecting upon losing the election for the superintendent of public instruction by 1%. Yeah. And more recently, you're realizing it was a 1% blessing, not a 1% loss or 1% gain or whatever.
So, yeah, I feel like it was a gift from God. God just knew exactly where schools were headed with this pandemic. And he was like, Erin, I'm going to save you by 1%. Okay. So I feel like it was a gift from God and not a loss at all. Not at all.
Have you always been this devout in terms, and I'm going to make a distinction here, and it might drive some people crazy about religion versus spirituality, about the building versus the spirit of, you know, and it just seems to me going back to when you were 8 years old and you first got that early inclination of what your calling is there a defining moment where you really got in touch with God, she, he, or it, however? It seems to me that seems to be a major defining part of who you are, is that you are a spirit in an earth body, and you are a spirit and earth body having physical experiences, as the saying goes. Is there one memory in your life that you're going to go, that was when God flipped my bick, that's when the light switch went on?
So I think something in me has always been drawn to God. And I don't know that so my parents raised me in a Protestant church, in the American Protestant Church of The Hague, which is a very kind of Presbyterian style, Lutheran style church. No personal relationship with Jesus, very like show up in a dress on Sunday, You know, stand when you're told to stand, sit when you're told to sit, don't clap ever. very liturgical. That's how I was raised. I sang in the church choir, but it was still very liturgical. I knew even as a little kid, there was something more than that. Like I was the kid that was out in the woods writing in a prayer journal. Like somehow I knew that God was listening somehow. And I can't tell you why, because that's not my parents. My parents have a very private faith. I don't know that mom would describe herself as having a faith at all. She had an encounter with a pastor when I was early high school. One of the pastors that was, every 3 years we got a new pastor there because it was an international community and they didn't want to just have one denomination represented. So every 3 years we get a new pastor. And we had, I don't know if he was a Baptist pastor. I don't know what, but he was from the South. It was a white man. Never forget this. And he would never call us by our names. Huh. And my mom recognized right away there was a racial dynamic. So my brother and I were the only Black children in an all-white church. Well, actually, my friend also, we had another biracial family, but we were adopted into a white family and this pastor would never say our names. And my mother just stopped going to church. I think I was a sophomore in high school, but I was determined to go back to church. She never explained to me why until many years later, but I was drawn back to church. Now, when I came to America, I started going to a Black Baptist church and saw a totally different expression. And that resonated for me, just people dancing and singing and really being moved by the Spirit. Now I would say I'm more non-denominational in style, but I've always been drawn to the Spirit in some way and drawn to God in some way. The expression of that has been different over time. But I've always had this personal relationship with God in a way. Even when I wasn't living it out, like there have been years where, Erin was not living the way that she knew God wanted her to. But I've always known that God is there and that there is this God who is bigger than us and that I need to trust him to carry me through really tough times.
Well, and I think there's no coincidence that Martin Luther King established his civil rights, human rights movement in African-American religious thought. And I think many people are guarded, especially in this country, around evangelism and people trying to convert them into their way of thinking. And so this issue of freedom and independence and autonomy is important. That how can we have uniformity without conformity? How do we, you know, negotiate those tensions of paradox and irony and contradiction? And so that we truly would let people believe what they want to believe without evangelizing. But when the day is done, it's those higher spiritual values that you emulate and you embody. And why I wanted to talk to you today about, you know, and we have about the spiritual significance of human difference. Because when everything else is said and done, what else is most important? What are people going to remember? You know, you've heard this before. People don't care about how much you know until they know how much you care. So it is about the intelligence of the heart. It matters the spirit that animate the body and relationships and everything else that goes on in a community and how schools are the central organizing mechanism for that, bringing that community together across generations. It's really, and it's no, real quick, there's no irony in this that the first schools were in churches in the United States. After the colonization and the takeover, the schools were one room schoolhouses in the church.
To read the Bible. I mean, you know, so much of it is education
was exactly right. So now it's almost, are we educating people so they can be responsible for their freedom? And someone once told me, a friend of mine, that if we have a Statue of Liberty on the East Coast, we ought to have a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. And that responsibility is what you've emulated in your life. And that is, what is God calling you to do? What's in your hands, Erin? What are you grateful for here? You know, right? I mean, and that keeps you humble. I mean, when I hear you rattle off Danny Kaye and all these different people that you've hung out with and John Denver and you roll, it's just like, but I know when you say these things to myself, I'm saying to myself, she's not bragging. When you say it, it's, how becomes what? The how becomes what? When you say those things, it's almost you're humbled by it. You're grateful. Actually, how you're saying it is the attitude of gratitude that animates that's your lived experience. That's been your life journey. always at the right time, at the right place for the right reasons. You know?
I believe that. I believe that.
Yeah, and that is living in the grace of God. That is living in the grace of God.
Amen.
Yes. You have honored me in this conversation and our listeners. And I just pray that you continue to be healthy, that you be strong, that life in God inspires you and protects you so you can continue this work. Because your voice is an important one right now, particularly this critical moment that we just came out of after 4 years. And that is not blame, victimization, or guilt. That is, we got to bring our brothers and sisters closer and draw that circle to include that polarization that we earlier talked about.
Yes.
I'm gonna let you have the last word. What would you like people to know that you know, or how do you wanna you never get a second chance to make the first impression?
I'm gonna end with my three words: humility, humanity, and history. And I shared that with your faculty. Humility, could we just show up with the humility that we don't know it all? We are just vessels for God. We can't do it by ourselves. Like, we can't do this thing by ourselves. So could we link arms with other people around us? I'm no better than anyone else. I'm just another human on the planet doing this journey with you. Humanity, could we center the humanity of everyone who comes into our presence and see them as made also in the image of God? And then lastly, history, could we be honest about our own story and be willing to share our story, but also be willing to look at the stories of the communities around us and our own history as a country? We can't fix what we're not willing to face. So let's be willing to face it. So humility, humanity, and history.
God bless you, Erin Jones. This is Raymond Reyes with Interculture Yoga. Thank you for joining us today in this interesting conversation. Beautiful. Amen.